Today is December 27th, 2018, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Coming up, President Trump makes a surprise visit to Iraq. We'll have a live update. Two new films tell the story of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Welcome to Harvard Law School.
Ladies, let's go around the table and report who you are and why you're occupying a place that could have gone to a man.
And we'll take a look back at some of the significant events of 2018. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is back at the White House today after making an unannounced trip to Iraq to visit U.S. troops. It was his first visit to a conflict zone as president. Joining us is White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara. We'll actually get back to Patsy in just a few minutes. And coming up next will be the world headlines from VOA. Among the top stories in the world, Indonesia's emergency officials have raised the alert level for the erupting Anak Krakatoa volcano that triggered a tsunami that killed at least 430 people. Police in the Democratic Republic of Congo fired live ammunition and tear gas to break up protesters who are angry about their exclusion from Sunday's presidential election. North Korea announces it will not pursue denuclearization unless the United States removes what it calls its nuclear threat. An American adventurer is the first person to traverse Antarctica alone without any assistant in an epic 54-day journey. This is VOA International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Washington State University-led study proposes that a single domestication event some 3,600 years ago in what is now Central America led to the production of chocolate that many of us enjoy today. After analyzing the genome of cacao trees, the researchers say they were able to determine when the trees were first domesticated by ancient Americans to produce superior cacao beans, which in turn provides the basis for making excellent chocolate. According to the study, some of the qualities that those domesticating the cacao trees focused on included flavor, resistance to disease, and that it produced a stimulant called theobromide. Researchers noted that developing and enhancing those qualities also resulted in lower crop yields. While they may have been domesticated in Central America, the scientists say the cacao trees originated near what is today's border of southern Colombia and northern Ecuador. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And you're listening to International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel. As I mentioned a moment ago, President Donald Trump is back at the White House today after making an unannounced trip to Iraq to visit U.S. troops. Joining us now is VOA's White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara. Patsy, good to have you with us. Before we talk about the president's time in Iraq, I'd like to ask you about how he got there. Keeping a presidential trip like this a secret isn't easy.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The White House will take every precaution to keep it secret, starting from activating a small secret travel pool, that's what they call it, which means that only a handful of media outlets who are part of the White House pool reporters are informed that they are going and usually not given much notice, and they cannot tell anybody else. The White House also kept the Air Force One plane in the hangar in the dark instead of on the tarmac. And they also changed the call sign of Air Force One to a cargo flight to obscure the fact that it's actually traveling. So for us journalists in the White House, the rumor has been circulating for a while. About a month ago, I would say the president said that he will visit troops soon. Then yesterday morning, social media postings of aviation enthusiasts, these so-called plane spotters, begin to show Air Force One flying over Europe. So I immediately asked the White House. They did not respond to my questions. In fact, there was no one at the press office. The lights weren't even on. And the Marine was not at his sentry, which means that the president is not at the West Wing, the office part of the White House. Now, by that time, we were all very suspicious. but we only found out for sure when Press Secretary Sarah Sanders tweeted at around 2:20 Washington time.
There certainly were a lot of clues, though. Well, once he arrived in Iraq, President Trump spent time speaking with the troops.
We came to al-Assad to share our eternal gratitude for everything you do to keep America safe, strong, and free.
So, Patsy, what message did the president deliver to U.S. forces?
Well, of course, Christmas greetings, and thank you for your support and supporting the troops as well. And he also defended his decision to withdraw from Syria. He said that ISIS had largely been defeated, and now it's time for America to stop being the world's police, stop being a sucker, that's the word that he used, and let other countries in the region take care of their own security. He also said that he had no plans to withdraw troops from Iraq, which he said that the United States could use as a staging ground to fight Iran or even someday re-enter Syria. As we know, Iraq is where the president claims his greatest military victory, the defeat of Islamic State in Mosul, although his claim of victory over Islamic State from Syria is creating a lot of controversy in Washington, D.C., including triggering the resignation of not only the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, but also the special envoy to the Global Coalition Against ISIS, Brett McGurk, who have both resigned in protest.
Well, Patsy, I know after leaving Iraq, he made one more stop before heading back to Washington. Where was that?
Yes, so President Trump spent 3 hours in al-Assad base, and then he went to Germany to another air base on his way back for refueling to the Ramstein Air Force Base and also see his service members there. As you know, there are about 30,000 U.S. military personnel in Germany. One really quick note, though, the Iraqis were upset that the president made a visit in Iraq without telling them because, you know, some of them are saying that this is a violation of diplomatic norms and Iraqi sovereignty. And there's also a bit of a kerfuffle that the Iraqi prime minister, according to the White House, had originally wanted to meet or was scheduled to meet President Trump at the air base, but turned it into a phone call instead. And the prime minister's office said in a statement after Trump's visit that differences in point of view led him to canceling the face-to-face meeting.
We have about 20 seconds left, Patsy. After a long trip like that, does the president have anything on his agenda for today?
Well, right now we haven't seen anything from the White House. White House usually releases what's called the daily guidance or the president's schedule the night before. It's been interesting to note that during the shutdown, they have not done that. And I don't know why this is happening the way it is right now. But as far as we know, the only information that we have so far is that there is a lunch lid, meaning that the White House is saying that nothing is going to happen until 1 p.m., so that's in about 45 minutes. We'll see if the White House will release any more information about the president's schedule today. We do know that both chambers of Congress, the Senate and the House, is scheduled to gavel in today, even though no votes is supposed to be taken. And we'll see if there's any movement, especially about the shutdown over the funding for the border wall.
All right, Patsy, a lot of information there, a lot to look forward in the next few days. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Jim Bertel, and this is International Edition. The U.S. commander of foreign forces in Afghanistan traveled to Pakistan Thursday to discuss Afghan reconciliation efforts with Pakistan's military chief. This comes just days after Pakistan held another round of talks with its staunch ally, China, on what they called the evolving political dynamics in Afghanistan amid reports the U.S. plans to reduce its military presence in the war-ravaged country. Joining us now is Michael Kugelman, director of the Asia program at the Wilson Center. He spoke with VOA's Ira Melman about the many issues ahead.
Well, there's a lot to unpack, for sure. I think that the President Trump's decision to withdraw half of the U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan has set in motion a lot of diplomacy. And I think that Pakistan now sees that it can play an even bigger role than it had originally thought it could play in a potential peace process with Afghanistan. I mean, I think that the fact that President Trump has now declared a partial withdrawal from the country, I think will really cause the U.S. to lose a lot of leverage at the negotiating table, simply because it's basically given the Taliban what it's always wanted, and the Taliban hasn't had to give up anything in return. So on the assumption that the U.S. role and presence in Afghanistan will be receding quite soon, I think that allows Pakistan an opportunity to step up to the plate and use its influence to work with the Taliban to try to bring it to the peace table. And I think that it would look to certain partner countries. And in this case, essentially all of the countries that Foreign Minister Qureshi has traveled to or is planning to travel to, China, Russia, and Iran. And, you know, the ironic thing is, you know, is these are countries that don't get along with the U.S., but they're countries that do get along with Pakistan, and which Pakistan feels can help Islamabad try to bring the Taliban to the table and try to start talking.
Is this what you think President Trump meant to do?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that the optimistic view is you could say, OK, Trump decided to announce this withdrawal of 7,000 troops as an olive branch. It was meant to extend an olive branch to the Taliban. It was meant to be a concession to say, well, look, we know that you've always have wanted us to indicate that we're ready to withdraw our forces. And then, you know, we've done that. And now, you know, we'd like you to step up to the plate and we'd like you to start talking and negotiating an end to the war, preferably with the Afghan government. But I don't think that's what's happened. I don't think that Trump announced this withdrawal of U.S. troops because of anything connected to the fledgling peace process with the Taliban. I think Trump announced this withdrawal from Afghanistan simply because he was fed up with staying there. He had never been comfortable in Afghanistan. You know, he almost, according to his own claims, he almost decided to pull out last year instead of agreeing to stay and add a few thousand more troops. So I think that he felt that now was the time. He, of course, had also announced a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria, and he thinks he's looking at the domestic political situation in the U.S. He knows that he's increasingly vulnerable. He knows that presidential election is not that far away. The U.S. presidential election is not far away, and he knows that his core base in the U.S. does not support extended U.S. military presences abroad. So I think that he was basically just making a unilateral declaration of the withdrawal because he just had concluded that he does not want to be in Afghanistan anymore.
That's VOA's Ira Melman with Michael Kugelman, who is with the Washington-based Wilson Center. Thank you both for joining us. From the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul in October to the unprecedented June summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, 2018 turned out to be another momentous year. Jonathan Edelman is a professor of international affairs at the University of Denver. He told VOA's Victor Beatty events of this and previous years leave him wondering whether the world is going in the right direction.
All the expectations that we had about the end of the Cold War by 1991 are gone. So many of the things that you're talking about were negative or something to even be worried about. You look at Britain, and if Jeremy Corbyn wins, we're going to have an England that is going to be going downhill very fast. In France, we had regular elections, and now we see massive burning in the streets and every weekend. We see Saudi Arabia not able to put its act together, that they were trying initially to become not just more friendly to Israel, but to the United States, and now that's all backed off. So that there's a danger here. And I think it's exaggerated, but it's real, that we may not be going in the right direction, in the direction that we hope to move towards democracy, to move towards some kind of neo-capitalism, to move towards prosperity for many countries that had had it before. And so if you really think about it, every time this has happened in history, there's been a reaction. In 1918, everybody said, it's over. It's the war to end all wars, one famous book calls it. And within 15 years, Adolf Hitler was in power, and in 20 years, 60 million people were to die in World War II. And then after World War II, well, it's impossible to happen again. But we got within 2 years, 47, the Soviet Union, and we got a Cold War with nuclear capability. So it hopefully won't happen, but it's just eerily beginning to look like it's possible.
You're forecasting some sort of cataclysm unless we change course.
I don't think it's the majority likely, but it's now for the first time since 1991. It's a real possibility.
Well, then we've talked about trends. Let's talk about some of the big stories of 2018. What stands out in your mind?
Well, I think there's no way, whether you love him or hate him, it's Donald Trump.
So what does 2019 hold for us?
I think, first of all, what's going to happen to Donald Trump? I mean, if you listen to the Democratic Party, he's going to be impeached. He's going out of office. If you listen to the Republican Party, which still controls the Senate and the presidency, they think that it's going to be good. So I think number one is what happens to Donald Trump, because it's very influential on not just Donald Trump's life, but also on what is considered acceptable behavior and what is also good behavior, because Trump also has some very good positives. I think number two is what's happening to Europe. Nobody in the 1990s, seeing the death of the Soviet Union, would have predicted that authoritarian, ultra-conservatives were going to be able to take over. Now, they're not the same people that we thought, but new groups have come up. And that shows one other thing. It's not just them. It's that what we're seeing indicates that it's becoming acceptable, the far left and the farther right. And that's something that's to be very concerned about.
Jonathan Adelman said if Britain leaves the European Union in 2019, that would open up the possibility of a host of mostly East European countries like Hungary following suit. As for Russia, he said, despite its nuclear threat, the country today is an economic basket case where millions of Russians want to emigrate. As for China, with its economic disparity, he looks for the potential for political upheaval, while Iran, he warned, could pose one of the world's biggest threats. This is VOA's International Edition.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Do you love music from Africa and the world? VOA has the latest hits, interviews with the artists, and we are glad to take your requests. The Voice of America has what you're looking for. We have music shows to please everyone. Join us on the radio or on the internet to listen day or night. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on your favorite program. Just follow your ears. Music from Africa and the world. We've got it on VOA.
This is International Edition. Thanks for being with me today. More than 750,000 Rohingya Muslim refugees who fled military attacks in Myanmar remain in Bangladesh camps as future repatriation and resettlement plans remain unclear. Steve Stanford reports on the challenges that lie ahead for the Rohingya in the coming year.
Across the sprawling camps in Cox's Bazar, close to a million Rohingya Muslim refugees remain in limbo without a clear future. Voluntary repatriation plans last month were postponed amid security concerns about ongoing abuses and a lack of international monitoring. Published footage of a resettlement compound being built on the remote Basanchar Island is another cause for concern, says a rights activist.
UNHCR has not been let on to the island right now to be able to do a risk assessment of the flood conditions. But many say that the island is prone to flooding and very dangerous. That means that hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees could potentially be on a flood-prone island.
While the long-term impact on the Rohingya population has yet to be felt, the prolonged refusal of education will be damaging, says John Quinley.
There is no formalized access to education in the camps right now. Rohingya that Fortify Rights has spoken with believe that this is a major issue for future generations of Rohingya children and youth.
Yet, it is unclear if the Rohingya will have anywhere to go back to in Myanmar someday. Myanmar authorities say land that has been burned becomes government-managed property, casting into doubt the ownership of more than 200 Rohingya villages that were burned to the ground in the past year and a half. Rohingya lawyer Jala Ong, a humanitarian award recipient, says official records can prove rightful ownership, provided they are requested.
They have all the documents, all the records in land record office and in home minister. International community should ask the government to show the this record.
Analysts see Myanmar's position as a deliberate attempt to eliminate the ethnic group, a charge consistently denied by officials in Myanmar.
The government making us to be illiterate so that they can allege these people, they are illegal immigrants from Bangladesh. They have no knowledge of the country, no knowledge of the world.
As the new year approaches, many in the camps wish for a peaceful future. Steve Sanford for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has developed a cult-like following. VOA's Penelope Pulu reports on two new films about her.
There are 178 laws that differentiate on the basis of sex. Women can't work overtime.
We have to get credit cards in our husband's name.
We're not allowed to work in mine.
This is amazing.
The film On the Basis of Sex follows the challenges Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg faced in a man's world, starting with her first year as a law student at Harvard in 1954.
Welcome to Harvard Law School.
Ladies, let's go around the table and report who you are and why you're occupying a place that could have gone to a man.
The film also looks into her private life as a mother and a wife. At some point, she was supporting her convalescent husband, who had suffered testicular cancer, by attending both her classes and his at Harvard. Daniel Stiepelman, the film's screenwriter and Justice Ginsburg's nephew, told VOA that apart from Ruth Bader Ginsburg's legal acumen and her inroads to women's rights, he wanted to share his firsthand experience of Justice Ginsburg's equal partnership with her husband, renowned tax law attorney Martin Ginsburg.
My wife and I have always looked to Aunt Ruth and Uncle Martin as our role models for what a marriage is supposed to be like. They shared the load raising their kids and getting food on the table and taking care of the house, and we knew that that's how we wanted to be as well.
You've been ready for this your whole life, so go in there and let the judges see the Ruth Ginsburg I know.
Actor Armie Hammer interprets Martin Ginsburg.
I think it's great for women to see a movie about a woman who changed the world without needing superpowers.
Felicity Jones plays Justice Ginsburg, a role she found, to say the least, challenging.
It was nerve-wracking at first. You know, you don't enter into that lightly. So it was about becoming her in every single way and doing justice to her story.
I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks.
The documentary RBG chronicles Justice Ginsburg's life from birth to her immigrant Jewish family in Brooklyn, New York, to her fights and legal victories for gender equality before the Supreme Court. That led to her appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1993 by President Bill Clinton, and then her rise as a pop culture icon after publications and websites coined her as Notorious RBG.
Every time Justice Ginsburg wrote a dissent, the internet would explode.
Would you mind signing this copy?
I am 84 years old and everyone wants to take a picture with me.
Sue Cassidy has dedicated a box to her as part of the company's Phenomenal Women chocolate line.
She has her own box and we can't keep them in stock. They are just selling like crazy.
A year after the death of her husband, Justice Ginsburg spoke with VOA's Julie Tabo about her legacy.
I hope that I will be remembered as someone who loves the law, loves her country, loves humanity, prizes the dignity of every individual, and works as hard as she can with whatever talent she has to make the world a little better than it was when I entered it.
That's VOA's Penelope Pulu reporting. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and our thanks to director Dan Brown, engineer Justin Fates, and I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Have a great day.